At the time when I first entered college, a book was published, both in the United States and in Great Britain, by a part-time scientist. I would call him an intellectual. I would not call him a great scientist in terms of making any particular breakthroughs. But he wrote a book. His name was C.P. Snow. Yeah, he's not remembered widely today. But that book became a kind of international sensation. And it was on the two approaches to knowledge, scientific knowledge in the sense of the hard natural sciences and social sciences and humanities. There's always been an awareness, I think, throughout Western civilization's history that there's some kind of fundamental division between the two kinds of knowledge, scientific knowledge and knowledge of society. It goes back to the Greeks. And the difference between what the Greeks would call nomos and physos, that is, nomos being the laws of society, the social order, physos being the laws of nature. There's this dualism that, in a sense, man is more than nature, he's more than an animal, and yet, in some fundamental way, he is part of nature, and therefore, to some extent or other, he's governed by laws of the universe. So is he a beast, or is he something more? And this argument has gone on throughout the history of the West. It still goes on, especially in departments of psychology, where there really isn't any agreement on this. Snow wrote this popular book, again, not read much anymore, but for a time he was sort of a sensation. A few years later, the Encyclopedia Britannica company hired him to write a little article for an annual publication that they put out. They would get famous scholars to write educated pieces that were not too difficult to understand, but at least could be regarded as pretty good statements of an intelligent person on some fundamental problem. In that statement, in this encyclopedia annual production called the Britannica Roundtable, in 1972, Snow made the following statement. I believe life, human life, all life, is a singular chance, a fluke, which depended on all manner of improbable conditionings, happening at the same time, or in the same sequence of time. Between 10 and 20 billion years ago, there was a big bang, and the universe started. Before that, time did not exist. This is something our minds are not able to comprehend. Then he went on to say, it has all been a very unlikely process, with many kinds of improbability along the way. If any ask me on what basis I make these assumptions, I have no answer, except to affirm that I do. Some will say I am making them because under the intellectual qualifications, I am a residual legatee of the Judeo-Christian tradition. I doubt that. I have a nostalgic affection for the Anglican Church in which I was brought up, but for me, its theological formulations have no meaning, nor have any theological formulations of any kind. Now that is an astounding statement. One, it is astounding in that it's quite open in the fact that he had no intellectual defense of the position. And secondly, it is astounding in its naivete in which he said he had no theological opinion. For everything that he said about the Big Bang, everything that he said about the sequence of events, everything he said about the improbability of a chance series of events was heavily laden with a theology regarding cause and effect in the world. If he were to go into a typical university classroom today, and if you were to present at least the beginning of that statement, not so much his personal statement about Anglican theology, but the statement about the Big Bang and the timing of the Big Bang and the sequence of events being improbable, and that there was no time prior to the Big Bang, probably a majority, and perhaps a large majority, of the professors on the campus would say that is generally an accurate summary of what we believe today. It is certainly what is still believed in astrophysics. Now they've got it, they've narrowed it down. Now they've got it down, I think, to the last time I checked on Wikipedia, it's 13.3 billion years ago that the Big Bang took place. And you say, well, what happened before the Big Bang? That, by the way, is the child's question. Before God, what was there? Well, the grown-ups got very sophisticated and said, well, before the Big Bang, what was there? And the answer is not much more sophisticated than what the parent tells the child, except they say there was no time before that. Really, and what do the scriptures say? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So we have a debate over origins, and I believe that all debates in terms of cosmology, all debates in terms of ethics, all go back to the question of origins. That is creation. Similarly, once created, once the process begins, however improbable it might have been, then it hinges on eschatology, the doctrine of the last judgment, the doctrine of final things. And somewhere in between the Big Bang at 13.3 billion years ago and the heat death of the universe, which you'll be glad to know they say is certainly several hundred billion years away, somewhere between the beginning and the end, the meaningless beginning and the meaningless end, there is us. And then the debates begin. Who are we? Where are we going? How do we get there? All of the questions, the great questions of ethics, all of the great questions of history, all come down to this peculiar sequence of events which begins with a meaningless Big Bang before which there was nothing, and the final heat death of the universe in which there would be nothing moving. In between those events, we appear. And the battle is over us. Who we are, what our responsibilities are. In other words, who's in charge here? To whom do I report? What are the rules? What do I get if I obey or disobey? And does this outfit have a future? The covenant of questions. The question of sovereignty, authority, ethics, sanctions, and time. Those are the five biggies. And they are a package unit, and every social philosophy deals with all five of them to one degree or other. And that's where it sorts out. That's where the battle sorts out. So when you go onto a campus and into a classroom, you're going to find that the content of each of the classes is, to one degree or another, resting on this five-point assumption. There's a kind of rule that you better get ready for, and that is the closer you get to the doctrine of God, the more consistently perverse the content of the class. It's worse with God. That's as bad as you can get it. They will be off-center. The most off-center you'll find them is in the doctrine of God. Next, they'll be almost as bad with the doctrine of man. That is psychology. and the social sciences generally, but certainly the doctrine of man and how that plays out in society. Then you get to where it's not quite as bad, which would be physics and chemistry and engineering. But if you get to astronomy, then the issue of origins and the issue of finality reassert themselves, and astronomy has built-in assumptions that are clearly based against what the scriptures tell us in the first chapter of Genesis. This is why those who major in engineering, perhaps those who major in mathematics, will not have quite so hard a time as those who major in biology and geology and paleontology. And those guys will probably not have it quite so rough as the people who major in psychology. And if anybody majors in theology, it's going to be a long, long battle, after which you're not employable by anybody. So be aware that that's the situation. The battle comes because there is warfare over the five covenantal points. Now, what happens in terms of the majors? Well, I've warned you that, again, the closer you get to God, the tougher the time you're going to have. The closer you get to causality, what we would call natural causality, physis rather than nomos, the less trouble you're going to have with the epistemology and the more trouble you're going to have with the mathematics. So people who are not good at math will usually have a tougher time epistemologically on the campuses, tougher time in terms of the battlefield, than those who are really whizzes at math. Because the math guys, the math keeps them on track, and that's the great screening device, whereas for those mathematically challenged, the screening devices tend to be the five covenant points of sovereignty, authority, law, sanctions, and time. And the difficult thing about this is that it tends to be that the real victims on that campus, in terms of the content, are the ones who've never been exposed to anything else, who've come up through the entire public school system. Because they're really coming into the last round of thought. They're really coming to the last time in their lives, probably, where they're going to sit down and read fat books and underline them and take notes on them and have to review them and generally have to use their brains in a systematic way, because that's what's required by their environment. Once you get out of college, that setting pretty much ends, unless you go into some research field, and most people don't. So in that last hurrah of youthful inquisitiveness, when somebody is actually paying you to sit and read a book, in that final stage, the student who has gone K through 12 in the public school system is run through the meat grinder one last time and sent out into society. He may not have much of a battle at all, intellectually speaking. It may be pretty much duck soup for him, because he's not learning anything particularly new. He's not in a confrontation with his professors. He's taking his notes and regurgitating what he remembers of the notes in the exams as fast as he can. He takes the true-false exam. He takes the multiple-guess exam. And if he passes, he gets his degree and goes out into the cold, cruel world. And that's the last time he really systematically uses his brain to try to deal with what we assume are fundamental questions of life. Now, the Christian has a kind of baptism of fire, because he's in the meat grinder. Now, some are more self-conscious than others. I suspect the ones coming out of the what we call the homeschool movement, the independent household movement, which the mother is probably in charge of most of the educating, or perhaps some online teacher. that student is probably more ready for the meat grinder than the secular humanist student, because he's already been chewed up and spit out. It happened a lot earlier for him. So the confrontation becomes clearer for the student who has been, in a sense, immunized and isolated from the process, from the 5 points of the covenant, as I would say, humanism, which is, there is no God, the Bible is not the word of God and authoritative, ethics is situational, there is no hell, and it ends in the meaningless heat death of the universe. Now, by the way, on the fourth point and fifth point, a lot of them haven't thought it through. They won't deny it. If they know anything about modern cosmology, they won't deny it, but they probably haven't given a lot of thought to it. But it's a crucial thought, because it means everything. It means life is a gigantic snuff film. Life is a snuff film. And they don't want to think about that, but that's the implication of the position. But on the first 4 points, they're pretty consistent. The assumption of the Darwinist is this, and they don't say it openly, at least until you get to college, but here is the assumption. This is inherent in the system, not just the modern form of Darwinism, but from the very beginning. The assumption is, prior to man, there was no purpose. That's the assumption. That's the bedrock statement of faith. Prior to man, there was no purpose. There was no cosmic purpose. That the processes were, in some sense, random on one hand, and on the other hand, totally governed by natural law, gravity, and so forth. Now that, by the way, they don't say that about the Big Bang. There weren't any laws with the Big Bang. But after the Big Bang, a few nanoseconds into it, then you get natural law, gravity, and so forth. There is no purpose in the universe, no directionality, no sense of we're moving towards the future, no sense of cosmic planning. It is a purposeless system. That's the heart of Darwinism. But then comes man. And this is the ringer, my friends. This is where they throw you the ringer. Somehow, because of man, there is now purpose. Because man is self-conscious. And man has logic. And man has purpose. And man can change the world around him by means of scientific, by means of scholarly investigation. That is, man has power. You see the point? It starts out with, there is no God. Now watch what they do. It's bait and switch. If you don't know the phrase, sorry, it's bait and switch. It's that here's what we're selling you, and then all of a sudden the thing is thrown into the back, and what happens to point two of the covenant authority? All of a sudden, man, who is in the hierarchy under Christianity, man now is elevated up to point one. Man is sovereign. Why? Because there's no sovereignty beyond him. There's no appeals court beyond him. Man is the top of the hierarchy now. So what began as a statement that there is no creation, there is no purpose, then miracle of miracles, man evolves out of the slime, and he moves up now to the position that Christianity would say God originally occupied and still does. So man becomes the new sovereign. That's the bait and switch of Darwinism. The rest of it is smoke and mirrors. The rest of it is footnotes and scholarly articles and journal pieces. The bait and switch heart of it is it starts with no purpose, and once man appears, there is purpose, And so the purposeless universe now is infused with purpose by means of man. And you think, that sounds religious to me, and that is religious. What did we first hear about? You heard about it first in the Garden of Eden. Hath God said. That's where you heard about it. That's where it started. Hath God said. The question arises. Now, once you say, hath God said, what's the answer? I'll test it. Yeah? You'll test it. How are you going to test it? Well, I'm going to violate the rule. I see. Point three. And what are the sanctions? Well, it's death. Yeah, but what are the odds? I mean, really, what are the odds? If God isn't who He says He is, maybe the odds are pretty good that it won't happen. If God is who He says He is, none of the odds at all. Hath God said. So, Adam tests God. Paul said, the woman was deceived, but Adam was not. So Adam can't pass along the responsibility to the wife who was deceived. He has to take full responsibility, even though he didn't initiate the process. By the way, why does the serpent go to the wife? Because she's not in a position of final authority. That's why. You undermine the person below who is confused and is deceived, and then that becomes the agent for a self-conscious test of the primary decision maker, whose decision is going to stick for all eternity through time. That's what Christianity teaches. Hath God said. In the section of Genesis 1 that hardly anybody reads, around verse 14, there's a peculiar passage which you probably have not heard a sermon on. That is, it specifically says that God created the heavens, sun, moon, and stars, for a purpose, and that was that man might be able to judge the times. That is, for calendars. And that is how we do our calendars. Or at least it was until very modern times. The progression of the stars, the progression of the sun, the progression of the moon is sufficiently predictable that you know what time of the year it is and you know what time of the day it is. It specifically says in the scriptures that God created the sun, moon, and stars before He created man, for the purpose of man. That's the heart of Darwinism's denial. There was purpose before man. That's the heart of the battle. You go to that 14th verse in Genesis 1, that's where the fight begins. They can spiritualize away in the beginning God created. They can play all kinds of games with that language, and liberals do play games with that language. They cannot play games with the language regarding the creation of the heavens after the creation of the earth and before the creation of man. That system, they can't spiritualize that one away. They just have to say it's wrong. And yet it's the heart of our battle. There was purpose before man. We know that, but the Darwinist has to deny it. And so the battlefield gets set in front of us as soon as we move into the collegiate setting where things are much more self-conscious than at the high school level. And when you go into that class, the purpose and the meaning of that class is going to be said to derive from man. In the famous phrase going back thousands of years, man is the measure of all things. And they believe that. And the only ones who don't believe it are the ones who are the total radical environmental determinists. And you find a few of them in the psych departments. The rat maze people. The ones who believe that man is nothing but an animal and an animal is nothing but a programmed entity that responds to stimuli. Now, most people don't believe that, but some of the psychology people do. B.F. Skinner believed it, and there are other disciples of Skinner still in the classroom. And of course, there are all kinds of wars that go on in the psych departments because Freudians don't believe that. But there's no question that the logic of the position says that man is simply not a machine, but a biological entity that responds to stimuli. Well, okay, but who provides the stimuli? Oh, yeah, that's right. There was a cartoon. Once in a while, a cartoon really gets to the point. There was a magnificent cartoon about 40 years ago. And I think I saw it in the UCLA newspaper. It might have been one of the guys on the campus, but it was really brilliant. There are two rats down in the cage. And one rat turns to the other. He says, "You see this lever?" He said, "I've got this psychologist completely programmed. Every time I press down on the lever, I get food." This is the modern psychologist's view of God. He really does believe that every time he designs some kind of an experiment, that he is in control. But the point is, how can he prove that he's in control? To whom does he report? If he is simply responding to stimuli, then who's providing his stimuli? Is it a meaningful universe? No, he denied that. Is it a better psychologist? He would want to deny that. Is there something higher than mankind which has got us in a cage? Well, he says, oh, that can't be proven. But in a really well-designed cage, it couldn't be proven. You see the problem. There's no final voice of authority for the humanist, for the Darwinist, because it's always evolving and it's always changing. Now, these guys come with enormous self-confidence into the classroom to pontificate about the nature of cause and effect. But behind all of the pontification will be some system of the 5 points: sovereignty, hierarchical authority, law, system of causation, and the future. There's always hidden in the system some assumptions regarding those 5 points. Now, if you're real sharp, if you're real alert, and you pay real close attention, and you read the textbooks carefully, and you listen carefully to the professor, if you're really good at this, you're going to figure out which of the 5 points he's pushing, what version of the 5 Darwinist points he's pushing. But they're pretty, some of them are very clever, and some of them, amazingly, are not very self-conscious. I think probably most of them are not very self-conscious. They've lived with this worldview from the time they were put into kindergarten all the way through grad school. They've lived with this worldview for 30 years. They can't sense what's happened. We had that too. You walk into your own house, you don't smell anything, do you? Unless somebody's cooking or something. You walk into the house, you don't smell anything. You bring in a neighbor, the neighbor recognizes that it's the smell that your house has. And you go into a neighbor's house, you can smell the difference. It's because you get used to a sense of smell or a sense of perception, and you don't think about it. We do it in grammar, we do it in almost everything we do. We grow up with it, and we think everybody thinks this way. I like to give a talk called, when I speak outside the country, I give a talk called "I Don't Speak with an Accent," which always gets a laugh. Because everybody speaks with an accent. But he doesn't perceive that he speaks with an accent, and most of your professors who have imbibed on this worldview for so long, they don't think very systematically about it, because they assume it's as normal as breathing in and breathing out, and they also don't speak with an accent. But your job is to figure out the accent. Your job is to figure out, as the famous saying goes, where does this guy come from? Where is he coming from? And by the way, when you ask that, you've got to ask the other one, where is he going? Where is this going? Some of them are more self-conscious than others. Most are not. But they're adamant. And what you bring into the classroom, the set of assumptions that you bring in, will be hostile or should be hostile to his conclusions. Now let me warn you that if you go into your standard class, especially upper division, and alarm bells are not going off in your head constantly, then you've got a problem. Let's not assume that these people are neutral. They like to say that, and it's only on that basis that they get federal funding and state funding. We're just a bunch of neutral scholars here looking into causality and reality. We don't have this hidden agenda. Well, of course they have a hidden agenda. The biggest agenda, of course, is keep the money coming. That's the big one. And the second one is don't interfere with my classroom teaching. But beyond that agenda, they have the specific agendas depending on which of the Darwinist camps they belong to. But what I'm warning you is this. If you don't spot it, if you, as you read a paragraph, if alarm bells are not going off in your head, then you may have imbibed rather deeply on the worldview that has been presented to you before you got to the campus. And you should be aware of this. It makes your studies more difficult. You will study more slowly than your peers. And the reason you study more slowly is that the alarm bells are going off. And you keep saying, but that can't be true. But that can't be true. But that can't be true. And then you have to think, but then what is true? And you slog down, which is why you're going to have a more difficult time of it. But in doing this, by the way, you really will have a pretty good mastery of the course when you're done. Because you will have thought through what's being said and the implications of it. And 80% of the people in the class roll through never really thinking about the implications of most of it. Because they're not at war. It's just the same old warmed over stuff that they've always received. It is a tough grind. But it's now there is an advantage. And that is, for a lot of you, that will be your last time where you really sit down intellectually speaking and run through these issues. Unless you teach your kids. Now, if you adopt a homeschool curriculum, and if you begin to implement some sort of homeschool program for your own children, then you're going to have to go back and rethink these things, because you're going to have to screen the textbooks and the workbooks. You're going to have to think carefully about what is really being said. At least I assume you will. You're going to have to think, I've heard this before, but I think it was in the college classroom. I think they were trying to get me to believe something or other, and that was leading over here, and now I'm seeing it in this, and is this correct? And if not, how do I fix it? Now, this is the project which I hope some of you will be involved in over a long period of time, which is curriculum revision. Curriculum revision is a vital aspect of the homeschool movement today. That is, all kinds of things need to be rethought, especially as you get closer to God and man. When you closer you get to man, the more you have to rethink these issues. Social theory. How does society really work? How should government really work? And why should government work in that way? How do economics really work? And why do they work that way? And is this consistent with what I have heard in the college classroom? Curriculum revision is no piece of cake. And yet it's a moral responsibility, because if you hand a textbook to a child and you say, read this, mommy thinks this is good, and the textbook at root is pushing some version of humanism, then you become, as they say, an unindicted co-conspirator. you have told the child, you can read this, and it isn't right. It isn't accurate. And you've got to be smart enough, and not just smart enough, as alert enough, as self-conscious enough, to read this material and say, that doesn't sound right. Let me give you an example. Have you ever heard the phrase, we the people of the United States? Who are we the people of the United States? Well, pretty hard to say. In order to establish justice and so forth. So who's sovereign in the United States Constitution? It says real clearly in the preamble exactly who is sovereign in the United States Constitution. We the people of the United States. Is that consistent biblically? You see the problem. Now if you go back to the state constitutions and the state requirements, not of all the states, but of most of the states in 1776, you find an interesting statement. To be elected to office in most of the states, they had almost the same requirement going back to the early 1700s. It says you have to affirm belief in the Trinity. To be elected to sit in office, state by state, you had to make a Trinitarian oath. And yet, in Article 6, Section 3 of the United States Constitution, it specifically says that no oath, no statement of theology can be established as a requirement to serve in federal office. Specific, right in the document, which people don't read carefully and they don't think about it because they think, gee, well, of course not. But that wasn't true in 1787, it wasn't true. It was after 88. So if you teach the Constitution, don't teach make-believe fantasy stories about the Constitution. Teach what it says and describe how it said it and why it said it and when it said it. And students are not taught to do this. And in field after field after field, you have an implicit atheism or an implicit agnosticism governing the first principles of the field. Economics is maybe the worst case of it. It was real self-conscious with those guys back in the late 1600s. They systematically said, we are not going to appeal to God, and we are not going to appeal to the Bible, we are not going to appeal to any kind of revealed system of morality. Why? Because they'd just gone through the British Civil War, and they concluded that nobody comes to any agreements anyway, and all they do is have war against each other. So we've got to find a way to build economic logic apart from God, biblical law, cause and effect based on the intervention of a supernatural spirit. We've got to invent economics so it doesn't have any of that. And they did. From the very beginning, they substituted mathematics for God. And that was in the late 1600s. And that carries through the 1700s, and it carries through to Adam Smith, and it carries through right into all of modern economics. There is an implicit atheism in all of modern economics. You teach a child to believe in the free market. Yeah, free market's better than socialism. Socialism's better than communism. There are levels of error. And some of it's really bad, and communism was really bad in terms of the number of people who died, who were executed, starved out under the communist system. 100 million people died in the 20th century because of communism. And the free market sure didn't do that. But you get back to the issues of the free market and how it's defended, and what do you find? God is specifically left out of the picture. Supernatural intervention is left out of the picture. Any trace of supernaturalism is officially pulled out of all of economic thought. And then you can go to the other fields. You can go to psychology. You find the same thing in the psych departments. You can go to sociology and they'll say, well, the belief of God is important. Yeah, the belief, people believe certain things and that has effect. But then you ask them, yeah, but are they right? Oh, well, we don't get into that because science has nothing to say about that. Yeah, but the Bible does. Well, yes, but the Bible doesn't say anything relevant except insofar as people believe certain things and that may have consequences. So what happens is God is shaved out of the universe. And that begins with Darwinism. Because what? Prior to man, there is no meaning. There is no creation. They shaved God out of the universe. And then once he's out, aha, we get to substitute a new God, which is us. Which is us. And so man becomes the new source of meaning. Man becomes the new source of righteousness. Man becomes the new source of legality. Man imposes the sanctions. It's man, 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 and pretty soon it's capitalized man. C.S. Lewis had a phrase, you can find it in The Abolition of Man, which is worth reading, and you can find it in that marvelous novel of his called That Hideous Strength. In That Hideous Strength, one of the bad guys, one of the really self-consistent bad guys, makes this statement. He's working on a sociologist. Well, that's who you got to work with. Not too bright, not too self-conscious, but useful. And this guy is real bright and real self-conscious. The character's name is Feverstone. And Feverstone makes this statement. He said, man must take control of man. Which means that some men have got to take control of the others, and you and I want to be the ones taking control. That's where it gets down to power. That is the question, to whom do I report? Man must take control of man. Well, that sounds marvelous. That's right, we're responsible. We've got to take control of our own destiny. But it always gets back to some men have got to take control of all the others. And then it gets real dicey as to how you're going to sign on to that one. And do you want to be the ones taking control of, or would you like to be the ones taking control of? Well, most people prefer to be the ones taking control of. And that, by the way, Lewis has this marvelous, very short essay. It's on the web. I beg you to read it 3, 4, 5 times, called The Inner Ring. And he understood the devil, and he understood how evil works. And he warned people. He warned these young men. He gave a speech to them. He said, sometime... These are young men going through the private school system. They would go on to Oxford. They would go on to Cambridge. They would go on to the London School of Economics. They would be the elite. So he wasn't talking just to a bunch of kids at a government-funded high school. Here's what he said. In this essay, he said, you're going to want to get into the inner ring. You'll see the inner ring. You'll see that there's certain people who seem to be in contact with the movers and the shakers, using our language. And you're going to be invited to come in. And it will be a very, very great opportunity for you. And then he said, but at some point, there's going to be a decision because somebody's going to come to you. And he's going to make an offer. And the offer is of something that is not quite right. And if you take that offer, you will be brought into the inner ring. And you may find yourself elevated to the heights. And he said, and at some point, you may also find yourself under prosecution and sent to a prison. But he said, you will gain entry into that inner ring. He said, do not take the offer. Then he ends it with a rather interesting statement. He said, the important thing in your life is that you're with a small group of people who understand you and who are committed, as you are committed, to a certain kind of work, and you can share with them your work and they can share their work with you, and you can have an appreciation for the importance of what you're doing. Wonderful statement. Now remember, he's part of a group called the Inklings, a bunch of scholars who read stories to each other. And out of the stories that they read to each other came the whole Narnia series and the whole story of the ring, Tolkien's ring, which in terms of the amount of impact those stories have had on the films and on pocketbooks, the billions and billions of dollars generated by those stories of just a bunch of guys sitting with each other, with respect for each other, most of them Christians, telling little stories to each other. Who of their generation had any kind of influence so great on the other side, in their inner rings? What I would appeal to you is this. You must understand when you hit the campus that a war is in progress. It's been going on for 900 years. You're going to be the latest entry, and you will come through it, hopefully intact. You will leave it, and there'll be the next generation who go through the process. This is an old process. This screening process, except for the church, except for baptism and the Lord's Supper, except for that institutional screening process, this is the oldest screening process in Christendom, at least in Western Christendom. This is Europe's great invention, the university, but it is a system of sorting it out. Now, again, let me go back to Lewis, who has, every once in a while, he has these insights. In That Hideous Strength, a wonderful book. There's an old professor who I think is kind of the Lewis character, because he's a professor of English. The old professor is talking to the wife of the sociologist who's being lured into an inner ring. And there's this other assembly of righteous people who are not trying to get anybody into an inner ring exactly, but they are caring for each other and concerned about each other. The old professor says this. He said, as time goes on, things become clearer. He said, 100 years or 200 years previously, the issues were not so clear. But as time goes on, things get clearer and clearer and sharper and sharper. And the decisions become more important. That's the closest thing to a statement of ethical history that I've ever seen in print. And I'll tell you where it is. It's on page 283 of the American edition, because I've quoted it many times. Things get clearer over time because the issues get sharper, because the battlefield gets bloodier, because the stakes get higher. 100 million people died under communism in the 20th century. The stakes got unbelievably high. And if you were on the wrong side of the concentration camp in the wrong country, somewhere between 1917 and 1991, you maybe didn't come out. Solzhenitsyn called it the Gulag Archipelago. The camps. And you went in and you didn't get out. A lot of them didn't get out. Millions of them never got out. The stakes got higher. They will continue to get higher. Now, I hope not nuclear war higher, but the stakes can get very high. Biological warfare, all kinds of challenges going on. The stakes are real high in North Africa right now. Since the beginning of the year, you have had a revolution the likes of which we have never seen before in North Africa. All across the northern tier, and part of it is in oil country, and that could have enormous fallout on our lifestyle, depending on which way it goes. The stakes are getting higher. Now, you have in the collegiate environment this sense of, well, this is outside the realm of conflict. It's a nice environment. You just have to go to class, and you get fed real well. And freshman year, you gain 10 pounds, and you never take them off. You go through this environment that seems so pleasant. And some of it is being misused on a regular basis. Well, there's more open sex in a university than there is in any other institution in the West, except the House of Prostitution. Except the House of Prostitution is a whole lot cheaper. But the parents aren't paying for the House of Prostitution, so they send the kids to college. And it's gotten worse, progressively worse, over the last 30 years. But I'm not talking about that. Bad as that is, I'm not talking about that. It's the seeming safety of it. It's the seeming pleasantness of it. Hail fellow, everybody's learning, everybody's advancing, everybody's coming to grips with maturity and so forth. It's a battlefield. But it's a hidden battlefield for most of the participants. It's a recruiting zone. They recruit the best and the brightest. Now, maybe they don't recruit the best and the brightest in the school you go to, but if you don't think they're recruiting them at Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Michigan, Stanford, Caltech, MIT, Berkeley, if you don't think recruiting's going on, you are really naive. The best and the brightest of the next generation. The ones they don't get there, they get them at Harvard Business School, Harvard Law School, Yale Law School. They recruit them. President of the United States is one of them. Harvard Law School. Made it to be editor of the Harvard Law Review. Not many guys ever do that. You think, well, you know, that's Harvard talk. You have that. Then there was this other guy named Clinton. He and his wife, they went through the Yale Law School. These people are recruited. They are wined and dined very early. They are brought into the inner ring. And there is power, and there is fame, and there is money, and there are all of the wonderful things that you get as members of the inner ring. And as Lewis said, resist it. There are better things than the inner ring. The content of every class, the battlefield, you're going to have to fight out depending on what your major is. Many, many years ago, long, long time ago, I wrote a book, edited a book called Foundations of Christian Scholarship, in which I lay down where the battlefields are, and I brought in bright fellows, specialists in the field. We covered psychology, history, economics, education, political science, sociology, and mathematics. And the mathematics chapter is extraordinary. These battles go on, even in the field of mathematics. You are called to serve, and because of the nature of the battle for the minds and souls of men, you are called to fight. You are both a servant and should be regarded as a servant, and at the same time you are a warrior, inevitably, because you're battling for the minds of somebody. At some point, maybe only your children, but still battling for their minds. And let me say in the old line of the experts, you win some and you lose some. But it is a war. Now, it's a war of service. Jesus said that we're not to exercise power the way that the Gentiles do, but that we are to serve, and that service becomes the basis of authority. That service becomes the basis of gaining control over others, not the exercise of power. And the service motif is basic to Christianity. And where that service motif is abandoned, then there's trouble. Then Christianity loses its salt. So you've got to look at service, but you've got to look as a warrior looks at service. Because I'm telling you, there are some people out there who want to get you in one of two ways. Either recruit you into the inner ring, or stop you. And people at some point have that decision to make. I think, frankly, everybody has it at some point. You'll look back and you say, that was the turning point. I had it there. It may not. Maybe you'll have two or three cases where it could have been. But there'll be a turning point at some point. Lewis is right. There'll be a turning point where you say, it's this way or it's that way, and the issue had better be clear, and if it's clear, you'd better make that right decision. And it's going to be different for everybody. Money may be attached, whether it be in favor, the triumvirate, right? Money, sex, and power. You get money, sex, and power, you throw that as a lure to anybody, it's a powerful lure. And be aware that that comes at some point. In the classroom, it's better to be thrown out. My associate, Arthur Robinson, we wrote a book together over 25 years ago, brilliant, brilliant man. Brilliant, brilliant children. Three of his children are now Oregon State University. Daughters, I think two daughters and one son, maybe it's two sons and one daughter, I've forgotten which. They're both in their final stage of their PhDs in nuclear physics, and they're all three being booted because their father ran against the local liberal congressman. Now, you can't prove cause and effect, but let us say in terms of timing, he ran, lost, and they're being booted. And they're raising money. They're trying to fight it. One professor intervened to try to defend them. Senior level professor, and basically he has almost lost his job. He may lose his tenure. These fights go on. The stakes are high. Now, these are good kids. I knew the kids when they were little, and they were smart then, and they are smart now. You don't major in nuclear engineering if you're down at the 100 IQ level. And they may lose it all. They may, all three of them, lose all of their work, and then they have to go off to some other university and start over, which is expensive for him and which is time-consuming for them. Sometimes you pay a price. There is risk to this. But the answer to it is, God will back me up. There is a better way. Stands must be taken. Don't go out of your way to make trouble, but when trouble comes, be ready with an answer, and a principled answer. And you may have that day of reckoning at some point. Well, you will have it. It may not be quite the stakes as visible as it is for the Robinson kids, but people have those choices. Whatever your major is, you had better be aware of what the Bible says about your major and think clearly about that before you get into that upper division work, because they will chew you up and spit you out if you are not self-conscious in a way that most of your peers are not coming out of the public schools. You have got to be, because you ultimately are the target. They're either going to recruit you, if they can, or undermine you, if they can. And you've got to see yourself as both a servant and a warrior when you go on to the college campus. In this battle, there are winners and losers. And in the next presentation, I'm going to talk about winners and losers in the collegiate battle.